This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
People say we're right-wing, we're right-wing, but if you actually sit down and look at some of our policies we've taken from left-wing. So we don't say we're right-wing or left-wing. We just say we have common-sense policies. We just want the country to prosper and everyone that lives in this country to prosper.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to another edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, there was some really good news from Medway Council. There's more concerns about the countryside being lost, the house building, and a former MP has emerged as a possible future mayor of Kent. Intriguing. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. And with me is Robert Boddy, who's been covering Medway Council this week.
Hello.
And Daniel Esson, who covers the district and borough councils.
Hello.
Plus, senior news editor Nikki White, who's been looking at the national picture for us. And later on, we speak to the new Reform UK County Councillor Thomas Mellon, the first from his party to be elected in Kent. First up, Robert, what's been happening down in Medway?
Well, some good news came for Medway Council this week when their social housing offering was rated by the regulator under a new set of tests following the Grenfell tragedy. It was the first time an authority in the South East has undergone a routine inspection rather than an inspection prompted by something being wrong. And this looks at the safety and quality of housing, the standard of tenancies, how effective they are for tenants, how effectively they use the council's properties, how transparent and open to the views of tenants the council is, and how effectively the authority deals with neighbourhood issues such as antisocial behaviour, domestic violence, and the safety of communal spaces.
So good news. Medway Council did well, did they?
So the scale ranks from C1, where the provider is meeting the expected standards for housing, to C4, which means fundamental changes are needed. Medway got a C2, meaning there is room for improvements, but the regulator believes the authority has plans in place to solve those issues.
And what issues were raised, and why not a C1 rating?
So the two key factors were that 45% of their around 3,000 properties had paperwork which was out of date, and 8% of their properties did not meet the decent home standard. However, the council has plans to massively increase the number of stock condition surveys, basically where they check over the condition of all their properties, to get its records up to date, and 8% of the homes are on a schedule of improvement. So the work is planned to be done to get them back up to standard. Additionally, they did talk about their big door knock, which is where 11 months of the year they just do a regular door knock, asking residents, firstly, is there anything in their property that needs fixing, but then also about sort of the conditions of the wider area of where they live. Medway Council says it's confident next time around it will be in a good place to attain a C1 rating.
Good news. What have you been looking at then, Dan?
So I've been revisiting a large and controversial planning application out in the High Weald, which I and many others thought was done and dusted, but the new government has unexpectedly thrown it back into the spotlight by giving it the nod.
So where's this development then?
So it's going to be an estate of 165 homes in a place called Turndon, which is near Cranbrook. Essentially, it's properly out in the sticks, and it's in the High Weald National Landscape, what used to be called an AOMB. It's been on the cards for years and years. Tunbridge Wells Borough Council initially approved it back in 2021, but the Department for Levelling Up, as it then was, overturned that approval with Michael Gove saying it was too generic and suburban to justify being built in such a beauty spot. But Berkeley Homes, the developer, challenged that refusal in court, and that was overturned by the High Court in 2023.
Oh, so how does it end up being approved then?
Because it was overturned by the High Court, it went back for yet another inquiry at the Planning Inspectorate, and the inspector argued Tunbridge Wells were right to approve it in the first place and they should have just left it. So Matthew Pennycook, a minister working for Angela Rayner, gave it the green light to go ahead.
What do local people make of this then?
I've spoken to a couple of Cranbrook locals who say that this basically shows the government think the countryside is fair game to concrete over, and that it sends a signal that it's going to be open season for developers. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Hugo Pounds, who's the Labour Group leader on Tunbridge Wells Borough Council, he was in favour of the plans in the first place, and is pretty enthused that his party at a national level have given it the go ahead.
So, Simon, what's happening at Kent County Council?
There has been much discussion about the awaited reforms to local government and what it might look like. And the current rumour doing the rounds is that government white paper was due now after Sir Keir Starmer's keynote speech this week. So December the 16th is the date that everyone seems to expect that it's going to drop. But it could be as late as the new year. But if speculation is correct, then the white paper may lay out the direction of travel for the government's reforms. How that will shake down in Kent is anyone's guess, but there are better than even chance that whatever happens, there will be a mayor in the style of Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester.
So where are you going with all this?
Well, one name that keeps popping up in the Conservative ranks is Craig McKinley, the former Thanet South MP and who's now in the red benches of the House of Lords.
And what did he have to say about these allegations?
Well, intriguingly, and I don't know whether he was just messing about, but I mean, he said that he wouldn't discount throwing his hat in the ring to be the Tory candidate. And listeners will remember the rousing reception that Craig received from all the sides when he appeared in the Commons back in May as a quadruple amputee for, following a really awful bout of sepsis last year. But he tells me he's fit and well, and I've seen him about the place and he is looking really fit and well. And although Lord McKinley has been something of a critic of the mayoral system in the country in the past, he says that if it's going to happen, it might as well be a Conservative one. So that's the reason why he's not discounting chucking his hat in the ring. Some local government observers think that the new system could be in place as early as 2027. But to be honest, no one really knows until we see what's in the white paper. Nikki, what's caught your eye at Westminster this week?
Pubs.
Really?
Pubs, yeah. Okay. A subject very close to my heart. They've been getting a slice of the limelight this week with Gillingham and Raynham MP Nishaba Khan. She's been highlighting the fight by locals to buy the Flying Saucer in Hempstead and get it reopened as an asset for the community. Ms Khan asked a question in the House of Commons this week, and the mission now has the seal of approval from Communities Minister Alex Norris, who is pledging to strengthen the rights of residents to take control of facilities that benefit them on their doorstep in upcoming legislation. He said he would welcome some further discussion about the Friends of the Flying Saucer and their campaign that they've got up and running. For those of you who don't know about Assets of Community Value, or ACVs as they're more commonly talked about, it's where communities can ask for a building or a plot of land that they love to be listed as an ACV by their local authority. To qualify, its main use has to have been to further the social well-being or social interests of the community, and is likely to continue to do that in the future. So it gives communities the opportunity to bid for those properties or land when they're listed for sale on the open market, and the ACV designation stays on the local authority's list for up to 5 years, helping protect it from redevelopment. So in the case of the Flying Saucer, that process began when the brewery that was running it, Green King, announced the pub was going to close in June. That inevitably sparked a wave of protest among regulars who said it wasn't just a place to go and get a drink, it was actually a vital social hub and it was boosting the well-being and community cohesion. So they lobbied Medway Council. Medway Council then classified that pub as an ACV, recognising its positive impact on residents' well-being and its valued social interest. So the site has now got gone on the market. And the owner has named his price at £1 million. And those leading the community takeover say that they've already had somewhere between 600,000 and 650,000 made available to them, either in the form of grants or loans and pledges. But they've also had an independent valuation carried out, and they say they're going to be offering a sum which is significantly lower. So they're doing pretty well. But while they're doing pretty well, they do feel that they could do with a bit more advice on things such as tax relief that might be available and match funding, and just that the whole process could be a bit easier and probably needs an overhaul. So they've been delighted that their takeover of the Flying Saucer has been raised in Parliament, and that came about after a meeting with Ms Khan herself. Mr Norris said the government will look to introduce a strong new right to buy for valued community assets, which will help local people to acquire valued community spaces when they come up for sale through the upcoming English devolution bill. When he came to address Ms Khan and her request for a meeting during a session on Monday, he added that the Flying Saucer was a great example. It was exactly the type of asset of community value that the government was talking about, and exactly the sort of asset that will be in the scope of this new community right to buy.
Sounds like pretty good news for the campaigners. In other news, last week we recorded our podcast ahead of the vote on the assisted dying bill. How did that go in Westminster?
Yeah, by the time we were recording last week, we'd only heard from a handful of MPs on which way they intended to vote on legislation. And that legislation that was being discussed was to make it legal for terminally ill adults in England and Wales to be given medical assistance to end their own lives. Some of our MPs were still deliberating up until the last minute, so they're obviously wrangling over it and really thinking carefully about it. In the end, nationally, 330 MPs backed the bill. 8 of those were from Kent, and 275 were against it, and we had 10 Kent MPs who voted against the bill.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Last month, Reform UK secured its first elected representatives in Kent, one on Dartford Borough Council and the other on Kent County Council. The latter, Thomas Mellon, is with Dan and I today. Welcome, Tom.
Hello there.
How are you doing? You're a Glaswegian from a working class Roman Catholic family. Tell me a little bit about your background and what brought you to Kent in the end.
Well, way back at the start, as you say, I was brought up in a Catholic kind of family household. I was an altar boy then. I was in the Boy Scouts. I was in the Boys Brigade. I was in the Cubs. So I liked a bit of outdoory things. Mm-hmm. And then went into the big bad world of working, shall we say. And got to know a few people and ended up in the building trade.
But you wanted to be a fireman, didn't you?
I did, actually, yeah. I wanted to be a fireman when I was going through school. So I set up most of my curricular activities round about the fire service, PE classes, science classes. And my mum wasn't too keen on me being a fireman, so...
Why not?
I don't know. I think it was a safety aspect. As mums worry about their boys, you know. Mm. So I think she was kind of not too keen on it, and she kind of persuaded me not to be by telling me I wouldn't pass the science exam or the chemistry exam needed to be a fireman or fire person. I kind of got dissuaded from it and ended up moving into other.
And eventually you got into the building trade and you worked on the roof of Bluewater.
I mean, we were working on some big projects in Scotland, but the chap I was working for, he got a call, would you work on Bluewater roofing? And that was one of the biggest projects in Europe at the time. So we jumped at the chance, absolutely jumped at it. Guaranteed work for months and months and months. So we worked on that. I was 21 when I moved down here, and I spent my 22nd birthday in a digs, shall we call it, in a B&B. I've stayed here ever since. That Bluewater project, that finished up as it was winding up on the roofing part of it, the same company that was doing blue water roofing. Mm-hmm. They had the contract to do Darren Farley Hospital. Mm-hmm. So me and a couple of lads stayed behind, worked on Darren Farley Hospital. Then that wound up, and then I went home. And then I got a phone call about a week later saying, oh, somebody's got some work if you're interested, because I'd been here by about a year and a half by then. Made a lot of contacts in Gravesend and Dartford, all those kind of towns where I'm knock about, shall we say. Mm-hmm. Got a phone call, asked me if I wanted to work at Glaxo Wellcomes in Dartford. Mm. So I went there, worked there for about a year.
Okay, and so that's how you establish your roots in Kent. You've said to me in the past that you're not really a political animal, but you always kept an eye on the news.
Yeah, I mean, back from a very early young days, I used to be able to watch what I wanted on a TV, and me and my sister, so it would be cartoons and kids' programmes. But my dad says, when the news is on, that's my time. So I used to sit down and watch all the news, all the programmes, like 6 o'clock news and if half past five local news. I used to watch all them with them at the time. And that's when I got interested in politics, interested in who are these people and why did it interest my dad so much.
Yeah.
So I was kind of intrigued. So it kind of piqued my interest. Mm. And then I kind of kept my eye on it ever since an early age, can we say, from 7, 8 years of age onwards. So
where were the politicians who caught your eye in those early years?
Well, I mean, I'm going back to late 70s, early 80s, so I would be saying people like Thatcher, Paisley, Kinnock, all the big names of the day back then. I was always intrigued, you know, like Ian Paisley. His big booming voice, he kind of captured an audience, shall we say. He had a mannerism about him, like a charisma.
But he's diametrically opposed to your background. Yes, yeah. He's a Protestant from the very much the loyalist end of politics, which is completely at the opposite end of your sort of Roman Catholic background.
Well, the thing is, I was brought up in what you would call a mixed household.
Yeah.
So my dad's side of the family were Catholics. My mum's side of the family were all Protestants. Mm. So I was brought up in a kind of mixed household. So one day I could be out in a Celtic top or whatever, out in the streets playing. The next day I could be following my mum down the road with the Orange Walk, coming up to Mayday you know. So I was brought up in a kind of, I didn't take religion too seriously. As in, I didn't take it a bit of a sectarian way.
What was it about Margaret Thatcher that, that caught your attention?
I think it was the TV time. She had a lot of airtime, a lot of TV, and she commanded a lot of respect. You could tell the way people would speak to her. She commanded a lot of respect, and she had a lot of self-confidence. She wouldn't go off the handle. She always kept a calm demeanour. It wasn't until I got a little bit older in life, and I've realised looking back that what she actually did for this country back in the 70s and into the 80s, leading up into the 90s and up until John Major took over, she kind of got a hold of the country. The country was going in a bad direction. We had winters of discontent. We had strikes all the time. And Glasgow was a dark, dingy place at the time, but after the 80s, leading into the 90s, all the buildings in Glasgow, it used to be black, covered in soot, coal, just covered in black. The whole city was like black. But they started sandblasting the buildings, and it revealed this lovely limestone or the red sandstone, and it made the city bright again. But looking back at it, the money must have come from somewhere. And if it wasn't local funding, it must have been national funding.
So it would have been Thatcher, yeah.
And then we went into a bit of a boom time in the 90s as well, I thought. The work was there for everyone. If they wanted a job, the job was there. So if you wanted to work, you could work. So there was no excuse for slacking about, you know. So I appreciated that as well. So there was a lot about the politics of it I like now more than I did back then.
Back then, What about Kinnock? I mean, again, two polar opposites. People that you've... maybe not admired, but certainly they caught your attention and you were fascinated by them, clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could see both sides of the point of view. I mean, about like my upbringing, I could see both sides of a sectarian argument, shall we say. I could see both sides of this political argument going on between Labour and the Conservatives. So I kind of agreed with some of what both of them had to say. And I thought, well, the common sense thing would be somewhere meet in the middle, you know. But... as we know now, politics has moved a bit far the other way, so the middle ground's totally shifted. So,
have you always been a sort of supporter of the parties of the right or right of centre, or have you...
I started off actually as a Labour supporter. I was more of believing Labour's policies about equal rights for workers' pay, that kind of thing. That resonated quite a bit with me. And bringing in the minimum wage... that helped a lot in this country, I think. But I was more leaning towards fairness in society, because I've always believed in fairness, equality, those kind of things. And that was what Labour were preaching. Still do, but some of the policies have changed more, because it's not the Labour of what it used to be. It used to be the working man's party Labour. But I think they've strayed from that philosophy now, and they're going down a different road. So I've kind of swayed on my opinions of who I want to follow now, and I ended up following UKIP. And then
Brexit
and joining Reform,
Was there a point at which there was sort of a penny drop where you realised, for example, you didn't support the Labour Party anymore, but you also couldn't support the Conservatives, and that there needs to be a support a right wing alternative party, which 10 years ago would have been UKIP, and today is Reform UK.
Well, on that aspect, I've only voted for the Conservatives once, and that was for Boris Johnson, and just so we could get Brexit done properly. It's the only ever time I've voted for Conservative. But the penny drop for me was when I was self-employed, working in the building trade. And the doors kind of opened up. Europe opened up. The so-called geographical eastern part of Europe opened up to the EU. And then we were flooded with decent workers, but it kind of made the wages stagnate. I seen what I was earning stagnate and then go backwards. So I actually came out of building trade at that time and went into the warehousing trade, because it was, number one, it was more stable and I was guaranteed a 9-to-5 job, whereas on the building trade, it was starting to wobble a little bit for, I would say, British builders. It didn't suit me at the time, because I'd come off to specialised trades, so I wasn't a specialised roofer anymore. I was just a building site labourer. So there was mass unskilled workers coming into the country taking unskilled jobs, and that was affecting me. So I seen it firsthand, and that kind of made me wake up a little bit. Why is this happening? What is the issues? What is the problems here?
And the long-term effect of that is that what prompted you to join Reform? I mean, what were the principal reasons for that?
It would have been UKIP. I started seeing UKIP policies, and it was like, immigration's great. It is good for the country, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not against immigration. I'm for pro-immigration, as long as it's people that we need, people that we're the doctors, the engineers, the scientists that we do need, nurses, anyone like that, fantastic, you know. But we've got enough low-skilled workers in this country that aren't working because they can't work. and it's stagnating wages at the time because there was no minimum wage at the time. So what happened? Wages started to fall. Wages started to decrease for your low-skilled minimum wage so-called jobs because, I said, there was no minimum wage at the time. So I seen my wages fall from like £5, £6 an hour falling away, and that was on agency. So it was like, I seen it firsthand.
There was a minimum wage when the EU expanded eastward, though. The EU, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Estonia, Latvia, all of those joined the EU in 2004, but the minimum wage was introduced in 1998. It's not to say mass immigration doesn't have an effect on wages, but there was a floor beneath which wages could not fall at the point that we opened borders to large amounts of people from Eastern Europe.
When you're on a building site, working on a building site, doing hard labour, you want to be paid a decent wage, you know. You don't want the glass floor to be falling away from you. You would like your living standards to stay the same. And if the market gets saturated by people taking your job or people willing to do your job for less than you, that kind of has an effect on the market.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, Kent County Council's first Reform UK councillor, and you're representing an area in the Dartford Borough. What do you see are the big issues in Kent widely and more particularly in your division?
Kent widely and my division. My division specifically is the roads. The Galley Hill Road has still not been repaired or hardly looked at in my eyes. That's an ongoing situation for the last 18 months where there was a landslide. I don't know if you were aware of the situation.
We've covered it,
So that's an ongoing situation. The residents are still not happy. They're still looking for answers. And hopefully in the next couple of weeks, I can maybe find out more about it because the residents are asking, we need an update. We need to know what's happening. And I can totally understand the frustration on that because it appears to be the powers that be aren't letting the local residents know what's happening at a local level. So this is where I'm hopefully come in. I can find out more and I can liaise with the local residents.
Yeah. And what about the big issues in Kent more widely?
More widely, I think it's road infrastructure, really. And the population, especially in the Dartford area, is one of the fastest growing populations in the whole of England in the past 10 years. So realistically, it's infrastructure. We're building all loads of housing estates, but we're not building the infrastructure to go around them. We're not building enough schools, we're not building enough doctor surgeries. And then the road networks we've got, the road networks, they were built for, say, the 1800s. A lot of the small old villages, like your Greenhithe, your Swanscombe, they're all small old villages that have been there for hundreds of years. So their road capability is...
Well, they were built for the horse and cart,
The road capabilities there, they aren't built for heavy machinery, as in loads of cars, or especially lorries going through the Swanscombe and Greenhithe area. That can be a nightmare. Lorries getting jammed because they can't go through the narrow roads. The local residents association, they would be able to tell you a lot more about that because they deal with it on a daily basis when they were in power. And it's not fair on the residents, to be honest with you. So maybe we have to look at that. And obviously, the big nightmare everyone knows about, potholes. Potholes are the scourge of the road right now. Any driver will tell you the potholes are unbelievable. So I would say that's a big issue at the moment.
How do you think Reform will approach the coming elections at Kent County Council? I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty about the future of local government as it stands at the minute, but you got an election to fight. What will Reform be fighting that election on? Is it just going to be slogans with Nigel Farage popping in, or will it be a more localised campaign?
We run localised campaigns depending on the area we're in. We're not whipped, shall we say, so we can focus and concentrate on local issues at Reform. So we would ask the residents, what do you need from us? We're here to help you. We're public servants. We're your liaison with Kent County Council. So what do you need from us? That's the way we would tackle it. If Nigel wants to pop his head up and make himself known and let people know there's an election going on, I'm happy to see that.
Do you think that Reform can, you know, get a full set of candidates across the 81 seats?
We're on our way there at the moment, yeah.
How many have you got?
We've overfilled over half of them so far. The vetting process has taken longer this time because, don't want to mention names, but there's a company we used last time for vetting. They weren't actually, so we went for a different company. We're doing vetting more rigorously now, so we get the right candidates, put the right people in the right positions this time.
Have you identified the divisions that you think you can win?
That's a subject we're going to sit down and talk about nearer the time. I think we're going to let Christmas get out of the way first, then we're going to sit down as a group and discuss where we can target, because what we've got at the moment, we've got a branch structure. So at the moment, the local branches are kind of deciding themselves what seats they think they can really target, because you know yourself, if you've got a Lib Dem stronghold in your backyard, the chances of you winning that Lib Dem seat are very slim, because Lib Dems, as we know, are an organised machine when it comes to politics and campaigning. So we would have to sit down and strategise a bit more wisely about where we want to target.
Okay, but can you sort of give us broad geographical areas about the types of places that you might fancy being able to pick up seats?
Well, the thing is about the reform vote is people can say, well, can you target a Conservative area? Can you target a Labour area? We can actually target both because we speak to both ex-Conservatives, current Conservatives, and disenfranchised Labour supporters at the moment. So we speak to a broad spectrum of people. So we can take votes from a lot of different angles. So again, it's another thing we'd need to sit down and strategise.
Yeah. Surely Dover and Folkestone, you know, must look slightly appealing though, because ate a massive amount of the Conservative vote. The Reform Party came second in Dover, behind the Labour Party, and came third in Folkestone, but very close behind the Conservatives. Yeah. Surely the areas where Reform's flagship issue of immigration feels most poignant, surely those are the kind of places we can expect to see a lot of resources put.
Well, absolutely. Even places like Sittingbourne and Sheppey, we came second there as well. So places like that, we're definitely going to focus a bit of attention if we put the right people in the right positions, give them the right tools for the job. I mean, personally, the campaign team I was working with, we were all from that area, and we've kind of set a benchmark, as it were, for the rest of Kent to follow. So if they follow our benchmark, there could be a lot of seats turning Reform.
What do you think Reform UK has become so popular? I mean, it's now regularly polling well over 20%, depending on which polls you look at. And what is the appeal?
I think it's the common sense appeal we've got, really. I mean, people say we're right wing, but if you actually sit down and look at some of our policies we've taken from left wing. So we don't say we're right wing or left wing. We just say we have common sense policies. We just want the country to prosper and everyone that lives in this country to prosper. So we've all got the same goal. We all want everyone to have a nice, safe, happy life, hopefully working, contributing to the economy, and then everyone can then prosper, move forward, have a nice car, have a nice house, the nice family, keep the crime rates down.
Reform UK is really just a one-man party. It's Nigel Farage. It's the cult of Farage before he became leader. I mean, Reform were doing nothing in the polls, really. I mean, they were low single digits. I seem to remember in the two areas that they've contested at the last elections, the last local elections, I mean, they got about 3% of the vote. I mean, it's nothing compared to what it says. And suddenly it shot up by more than 20%. Yeah. And suddenly all the other parties are beginning to look over their shoulder thinking, well, you know, how do we combat this? Sure. So, but is it just Nigel?
Well, I would be foolish to say it's not, but in a small aspect, there was a Nigel effect in the election, and everyone's seen it, because there were so many people, should I say, that were sitting on the fence, even some Conservative voters, even some ex-UKIP voters, and they were thinking, well, if Nigel gets involved, we've got a chance. So we'll get on board and we'll back you to the hilt. And that is what I call the Nigel effect. And that's exactly what happened. Nigel got himself involved in the election. Then we started seeing our polling figures slowly creeping up. And we've actually watched our membership go over 100,000 now. We're actually in a safer, better position now as well with Zaya. So the party's not just a one-man band per se. There's a lot of things going on behind the scenes that people don't know about in head office at the moment. Okay. And the Zaya effect, I can call it now, is actually taking hold. So we're professionalising, we're modernising, and we're moving forward properly as a proper political party.
Yeah, do you not think it's a bit concerning, though, because people on the British right and Eurosceptics have argued for decades that there's a need for a party, you know, however you put it, is on the right but different to the Conservatives, has a strong anti-immigration policy. But for, you know, almost 20 years, the successes of those parties have been basically completely tied to Nigel Farage's person. He led UKIP, he led, you know, what was the Brexit Party, and now has become Reform UK. There is no other alternative right-wing party in this country. Do you not think it's, you know, concerning for the future of that kind of political project that there is basically one person in the country who has a proven track record of success with that? And do you not think maybe that shows that there's a deeper problem in organising for that kind of politics if you can't really do it independently of Nigel Farage?
First of all, just pick you up, and we're not an anti-immigration party. We are pro-immigration in the right way. But Nigel has a lot of experience working with the European Union, a lot of experience, and he actually set some benchmarks back in the past. He was telling people 10 years ago what's going to come on down the line, and he was kind of right. So he's got a proven track record, and that's why I say we had the Nigel effect in the election. As soon as he got on board, so did a lot of people that followed Nigel and respect his political opinions. They got on board as well. So, but again, it's not a one-man band anymore. It's a team effort. Nigel is basically a figurehead. He's got a notoriety. Everyone knows who he is, and he drags along a lot of people that might not have known who Reform was until he actually got involved and became the figurehead of the party. And that's what's really pushing the momentum on at the moment. The fact that the Tories have lied to people for 14 years doesn't actually help, and that's why we're gaining traction on the Tories. I think our membership is now higher than the Tories' membership, which keeps plummeting every day.
There have been rumours floating around in the past few days that Elon Musk is prepared to donate $100 million to the party coffers. Do you think that's healthy? Do you think it's true?
Well, I can't actually say if it's true or not. I haven't heard anything.
Well, Richard Tice certainly wasn't denying it on the radio this morning.
Yeah, I haven't heard that interview myself. Yeah. The last thing I heard was Nigel was questioning it, and if the money was coming, he would welcome it, but nothing was actually said that it was definitely coming.
Mm.
But, I mean, I would welcome the money, sure. I mean, if someone was to say to me before the general election, here's a couple of £100 to run your campaign, I would be ecstatic, because we're all self-propelled branches. We have to raise our own funds, our own income. So every flyer I had produced in the general election, I had to come up with the funds myself via fundraising programmes, and everyone else is the same. So we don't work off our main party mechanism like the Conservatives or Labour or Lib Dems, where they've got a big pot of funds they can just dip into and spread it about in the target seats. We don't have that mechanism. So,
but there are caps that you can...
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, yeah. I had to stick to a rigorous spending cap, but But trust me, I came nowhere near that spending cap. So if someone came in like a big donor, 100 million or whatever it is they're talking about, what makes it different if one donor does it or 20 Conservative donors donate 100 million? Just the fact that it's one man doing it, it makes the headlines.
Does foreign oligarchs meddling in our politics not concern you? I imagine your party would rightly criticise the Labour Party if some European multimillionaire or Donald Tusk or someone like that was like, here's 100 million, Bob, for Keir Starmer.
Yeah, surely, but his mum's British. His mum's British and his dad's South African, so... really a foreign oligarch, is it?
He doesn't live and work in this country. He's an official of the American government.
He's got businesses in this country, so he's actually part of this country.
Yeah, well, and he also, I believe, he has some British business interests.
Yeah, he has got British interests in this country, so it wouldn't be as if it's some foreign power just coming in to try and buy an election. Let's be honest, the man's got tentacles all over the world, but he does have ties to this country, so he's not foreign to these shores.
Mm. Where can Reform realistically reach in British politics, do you think?
Well, I'm hoping we can reach the top. Even if someday we're kingmaker, and then we can reach the top after that.
Yeah.
That would be acceptable.
When you say kingmaker, are you talking about having the balance of power in
we might have to.
Westminster
or... Yeah, we might have to.
And same in Kent?
Wherever it has to be done. Politics is politics.
Yeah.
If you want to get your point of view across and you think that's the best way the country has to move forward, we have to cut deals, maybe.
Yeah.
Who knows?
The government's quite keen on having a mayor for Kent. Do you support a shake-up of local government?
It depends, because what I don't like is layers and layers and layers of bureaucracy. I like accountability. And the way we've got it at the moment, we can hold our local councillors to account. And we can hold our local KCC councillors to account. Maybe having a mayor, would that take that accountability away, and would it add another layer of bureaucracy that would then cost more money for the taxpayers in the long run? The Kent County Council taxpayers, how much money are they going to have to spend for this mayor? How much extra does it cost? That's what I would be looking at. Is it going to be beneficial to the people of Kent?
Thomas Mullins, thank you very much indeed for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
This week, the rumour mill has been abuzz with speculation that Elon Musk, the world's richest man, is considering donating $100 million to the Reform Party in a bid to help Nigel Farage become Prime Minister. This talk that Labour will look at changing the rules on foreign donations to UK political parties as a result. So what does this possibly mean for our democracy? Should foreigners be allowed to donate vast sums? Well, damn, what do you think about this?
I mean, I think it's pretty evident people who live abroad permanently shouldn't be allowed to meddle in our politics in this way, especially not if they're obscenely wealthy and quite feasibly have the ability to sway things one way or another. It's not it's not corruption, it's perfectly legal. There's not much regulation of this kind of thing at all. If the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia wants to try and purchase the Labour Party outright, he's more than welcome to give it a go.
As our guest said just a little bit earlier, Elon Musk does have a strong British connection. He does have British businesses. Surely if he wants to to throw some money the Reform's way, then he can do what he likes, really, can't he?
As far as the law's concerned, yeah, definitely. But I mean, it's the nature of the modern economy that the international super rich are by their nature extraordinarily international. And the height of this is countries like Qatar and Bahrain and Kuwait and UAE, where you can basically buy your citizenship. Thankfully, Britain hasn't quite debased itself to that level on the international stage yet. What I think would be interesting and hopeful is if Elon Musk does give it a crack, maybe the Labour Party would, as well as place limitations on foreign donations, start placing limitations on domestic donations, and because parties are disproportionately reliant on the charity of extraordinarily wealthy people, and basically allows parties to exist completely unmoored from the real world and with no base of active supporters, where if only individual people were allowed to donate and there were limitations on their donation, political parties would actually have to build active and engaged memberships, something which we haven't seen for a very, very long time.
I mean, during the US election, billions were spent on TV and radio advertising and the use of social media. It was, you know, absolutely extraordinary amounts of money coming compared to what we spend in the UK, which is absolutely chicken feed in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, elections are a massive industry in America. There's an awful lot of money to be made in it, as well as money to be spent on it. We're not quite at that level in Britain, but I mean, it does cost quite a lot. If you can use the Facebook ad library to look at what Facebook pages are spending on donations, and some of the top spending MPs and candidates in Kent, mainly Labour ones, were spending, you know, in the 6 week lead up to the election, 10, 15, 20,000 on Facebook advertisements. I don't know what 10 grand gets you in terms of Facebook views, but they obviously think it's important. But that's of a wholly different order to Elon Musk, who is an official of the American government now, or will be if he gets confirmed by the Senate and the House.
Was it Department of Government official, a Doge? Yeah,
yes, which is kind of concerning to see
cryptocurrency.
Yeah, to see that acronym make it into reality. But yeah, he's an official of a foreign state, in theory, offering a ridiculous amount of money to a British party in the attempt to influence the result of British politics. I think any government serious about its national sovereignty would try and block that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to ask whether we want the party that is in charge of our country is going to be the one that has got the best policies to win it, or whether it's going to be the one with the richest backers. I mean, some would argue that I guess already we're some way down that road, if not a long way down that road. But when you get people with such a high profile and with such a big amount of money to spend, such as Elon Musk, you've got to ask whether this is the right thing or not. I mean, Farage says that he knows nothing about this $100 million donation, and maybe he does or he doesn't, and maybe it'll be forthcoming or not. But either way, no money has been spent at the moment, and he's got an awful lot of publicity out of it. So he's done quite well.
He's quite good at that, though, isn't he?
Sorry?
He's quite good at that.
He is quite good at that, and maybe that's no bad thing, but it's certainly not done him any harm to get people talking about it, and we will see whether his profile being raised in this manner is going to earn him any more votes.
OK, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Rob and Dan, and our special guest, Councillor Tom Mallon. And don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news across the county. And you can also sign up for our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. So see you next time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.